Okay, yeah. You want me to say more? Okay, good. But as you said, you should be able to hear my breathing as well. This awkward thing. Yeah.
Okay, welcome everybody today. Will actually be the last class that we teach in this course. We have a guest teacher, my colleague Sokratis Katsikas, and he will also be, for those that will join the technology track, he will also be teaching the critical infrastructure security course in the third semester. But for now, he will give an introduction into that topic, right?
Yep.
Okay.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Patrick. So, good morning. And thank you for the opportunity to give a preview to the course of next year. And this is actually about advertising, right? Well, so I'm supposed to keep you interested as much as possible. You shouldn't expect the same thing during the course next year. But anyway, And I will not go to dance, okay? No, not for attracting you. Okay, so this is what it's all about. As Patrick said, I'm coordinating the Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience Group here in CCIS. And as you probably know, we will be giving a course together with Stephen Wolfson to the technology track starting fall semester next year, 2017-2018. So this is a preview, and since it is a preview, I will just give you the agenda of what I'm going to talk about today. Don't be scared. It's 70 slides. We will not have the opportunity to go through them all, but as I said, this is a preview. Okay. So just an outline at the subject level of what this course is about. That's the IMT 4203. It's the Critical Infrastructure Security course. And then we will mostly talk about this one here, which is the very first introductory subject to the course, actually. So I will give you more details on this. And then bullet points on the remaining subjects of the course, because these are actually the subjects together with this one that will be covered in the course. Okay? Good. So coming to the course outline, as I said, these are the course, the subjects that we are going to discuss in the course. First of all, introductory material about critical infrastructures and critical information infrastructures. There is a difference there, as you will see later on today. Then we'll talk about threat actors and threat agents in critical infrastructures, how we model them, particularly taking into account the interdependencies and robustness issues. We'll talk about cyber-physical systems and their security. By the way, are you familiar with the term cyber-physical system? How many of you have come across that? No? Okay. Good. I'll give you something that you don't know, at least today. Then control system security, that will mostly be covered by Stephen. And also control system protocols, these particular ones, and their security. And then the remaining parts of the course will be selected aspects looking into these items over there, and you can identify different areas of critical infrastructures. So actually what we will be doing there, we will be looking into case studies, okay, each one in these critical infrastructures. Okay. So coming into the introduction, first of all, let's have a definition and taxonomy of critical infrastructures. All these are critical infrastructures. Now, you know that there are, well, you probably know that there are formal definitions of what a critical infrastructure is. Has anybody come across such definitions? What is a critical infrastructure? I'm not looking for a formal definition. Okay, I'm just asking whether you know what a critical infrastructure is all about. Oh, yep. Right. Yeah. If just for the benefit of your fellow students that are not in the room, if you could speak louder when we do that interactively, it would be great, I think. Oh, yeah. We don't have that blue thing that we throw, right? I mean, and I wouldn't like to throw this one. No. Don't worry. To repeat the question, the answer actually. So, if I may repeat it roughly, it's what is needed to support the nation's well-being and running. Okay, yeah, that's what it is more or less. In fact, there are some differences in different definitions. At the European level, this is what you said practically, right? So critical infrastructures at the European level are defined as those infrastructures that are necessary for the well-being, not of the nation, but of the society. And keep in mind the difference, because you will see where the difference comes into play. Okay. Now, this is the European definition. Of course, every European Union member state have been requested, and they have complied, most of them, to give their own definitions of critical infrastructures. So the Norwegian definition of critical infrastructures, dating back to 2006. By the way, this legislation is currently under revision in Norway, but the process has not been yet concluded. And I don't think that it will affect the definition anyway. Are those constructions and systems that are essential to uphold society's critical functions. So even from that, you should be able to realize that critical infrastructures for Norway are related to critical societal functions. And this is the case. So Norway has identified those critical infrastructures. So it's power, energy, communications, water supply insurance, transport, oil and gas, and satellite-based infrastructure. And the critical societal functions upon that depend upon the critical infrastructures are those. So you can see several really critical things there. Of course, there is not one-to-one correspondence between, or even many-to-one. It's a many-to-many relationship here. So many critical societal functions depend on a variety of critical infrastructures. And this is how Norway has come up with defining its critical infrastructures. So again, this is from the same document. It's good that the Norwegian legislators have opted for explaining how they came up with the critical infrastructures. This is not always the case. Not all nations have done that. Okay. So they started from society's basic needs. These translated and covered by critical societal functions, which depend on infrastructures, but not necessarily critical, not up till now. These are assessed by criteria. What criteria? Dependability, alternatives, and tight coupling. Dependability is how much a critical societal function depends on an infrastructure. Alternatives is, well, if we don't have that infrastructure available, can we do without it? Do we have any alternatives? And tight coupling between both societal functions and critical infrastructures among them. So if these criteria are met, well, it's not an on-off case. These are assessed, and then you end up with an infrastructure being critical or non-critical. Clear enough? Good. So the legislator has come up with these critical infrastructure. An interesting question would be, can you think of any infrastructure that is an infrastructure but doesn't meet these criteria and therefore it's not critical? Don't try to answer that now. Just think about it. Okay. Another interesting thing to see how much this is country dependent. I think that Norway is the only country that has identified satellite-based infrastructure as a critical infrastructure. Every other country has included satellites within their telecommunications critical infrastructures. And I guess you can easily understand why the case of Norway is different between of the specific situations of communication in the country, the things that have to be taken care of, and the therefore the criticality of the satellite infrastructure per se, rather than as part of the telecommunications infrastructure. Okay, now the difference. This is the American definition of critical infrastructures. And if you go quickly through it, they provide essential services that underpin American society and serve as the backbone of the nation's economy, security, and health. If you look at it carefully, what you will see is that, of course, society is mentioned, but the criticality factor, or the factor that determines criticality in the American sense, is the economy, the security, and health of the nation, which is not necessarily equivalent to society. This is more of a national kind of definition. And this will give you very different results when you assess the security of the critical infrastructure against, for example, the privacy requirements that you must adhere to in a society of today. Just to put it in a nutshell and not being so, let's say, cryptic about it, there's a very different perception about the balance that we need to strike between security and privacy in Europe and a very different balance in the United States. Okay? Very different perspectives. And this is reflected here. So, now you know what critical infrastructures are and what you should be looking for. Okay. Our next item on the agenda then, some examples, horror stories, we call them, right? This is to motivate you. I mean, fine, yeah, okay. Critical infrastructure, this guy, I mean myself, I'm talking about this, the need to secure them, the need for them to be resilient, but is it really a problem? Well, let's do that interactively. Don't look at the advertisements, this is not my point, this is just from the page I visited, but how many of you are familiar with this incident? Okay, two? What about the three? Four? Come on, don't be shy. Okay, that's a good percentage for security professionals. Should I take it that the rest of you have never heard about the Ukraine incident? Ah, woo, my colleague, Patrick. Okay. Anyway, well, this is one of the most recent incidents that we have had in the energy infrastructure. This is one of the reasons why I put it up front. I think I have four examples in four different infrastructures. The other main reason is that my position is sponsored by Statkraft and Statnet, and therefore I have to pay tribute to the energy infrastructure first before I do so for any other infrastructure. So you have the reasons for this one being up front. Now, for those of you that are not familiar with the incident, here is a summary. December 23rd, the date is not accidental. Just before Christmas, people are relaxed, not many on duty and things like that. And the time is not accidental. 3:35 p.m. Okay, so this was starting the holiday period, actually, right? So there was a severe outage of power in the Ukraine due to a third party's illegal entry into the operators. The operator was this one. I will not try to pronounce it. Kiev Oblenegro or something, I never go, something like that. So someone or some ones broke into their systems and their SCADA systems, and they disconnected several substations for several hours. Is that a big deal? Well, the initial estimate was that only about 80,000 customers were affected, only. Okay? So it was a region. But later on, it was discovered that this was not the only Oblenergo. Oblenergo apparently in Ukrainian means operator of distribution. Okay, so let's say not Statnet, but local distributors. Okay, so three of them had been affected, and the total number of customers that were affected was 225,000. Okay. I will not give you the estimate of how much this costs to a national economy. You'll have to come back next year to find out these things. But I guess that it suffices to say that affecting 225,000 customers is quite a big impact. And in fact, it's interesting that this event, even though at, let's say, a global scale, is not one of the worst. We have had energy outages of a much larger scale. in the past, and I'm sure that we will have in the future as well. It became quite well known in Norway, and it did so because among those customers there were some banks, and you know that there is quite a good collaboration between Norwegian banking and Ukrainian banking, and therefore something there must have been affected, and this is why the interest in Norway about the event was increased at the time. Okay. So with globalization, the energy infrastructure doesn't affect only one nation, but it does affect much more than that. This is also a specific characteristic of the power network, which is globalized, has been globalized even before the globalization of the economy. So technically globalized. Now, this is still alleged. The fact that it was a cyber attack is not alleged. We know that it was a cyber attack. What is allegedly stated there is that this was because the Russian security services were involved in this. This is the Ukrainian side of the story. No one can actually confirm or deny that. And as you can see, my sources here are from the SANS Institute. Are you familiar with the SANS Institute? Okay, so you know this is a good resource for security resources. And I would say impartial enough to say that this was claimed by the Ukrainian government but never proved. What is of interest to us is that it was a cyber attack. Now, how did it happen? The first step, it's again from the SANS report. The first step was spear phishing to access the business, to gain access to the business networks. Familiar with the term spear phishing? Good. And I'm sure that you know techniques for doing that as well, both technical and otherwise, like social engineering techniques. So this was the first step. So they got access to what? To the business network. But is that enough? I mean, how can you, from the business network, can you move into the power production control network? What do you think? Is it possible? Well, you know the answer. I mean, it happened, so it must be possible. Should it be possible? The answer is no. But unfortunately, this is where we fail. Okay? We'll come back to that later. So, they planted the malware, Black Energy 3. Okay? And then they just stole credentials. You know that despite the very good efforts of Patrick and my excellent colleagues here, worldwide excellence in biometrics, still passwords are being used, what, in 80-something percent of the cases? Patrick, am I correct? Is it something like that? I mean, this is the prevalent way of authenticating. It's still very high. Yeah, maybe even more than that. So they just stole credentials. And then they used virtual private networks. Why is that? Cover traces to enter the industrial control system network. It's not only sufficient to get there, you should cover your tracks as well, unless you don't care if you are discovered later, and of course you're requested to pay the price of what you did. So it's a good idea to try to cover your traces. There were already remote access tools. That is RATS. Are you familiar with the term RATS? It stands for remote access tools. It's malware, actually, that allows you access from remotely. Let's keep it at that level now. Okay, so you can actually get control of whatever you want to get control of, an information system, a computer system, it doesn't matter, remotely. Or you can even have control directly into the system that you want to breach, not through the RAT. So that's what they did. Even firmware was affected. Then they used a modified kill disk facility to erase the master boot record of the systems. Why is that? Well, if you want to attack efficiently, you don't give the other guy the opportunity to recover easily by just rebooting. Okay? So you need to affect their capacity to respond and to recover. And also, of course, some logs, again, in their effort to cover trucks. They utilized UPS systems to impact the connected load, so they had to somehow increase the connected load. And finally, just to be complete, they also launched a denial service attack against the telephone system so that the customers were trying to get across to the customer service systems of the company, but it wouldn't work. Okay? So this was the complete, let's say, picture. Good. Second example. This is from Telecom. How many are familiar with that? Belgacom's hacking. Yeah, I would expect so. Only one. Ah, Patrick. Okay. I would expect so. It didn't gain much publicity. But if you happened to be in the CCIS Meet the Partner lecture that was held last Monday, not the Monday, but this one, but the Monday before, there were some lectures from Telenor, because Telenor was here on campus, and one of the people that gave a lecture was their CERT manager, or top guru of intrusion detection, and he made specific notes about the Belgacom incident. So what was that? This is, I think, a couple of years back. Well, three. It was there before, but it was discovered in 2013. So according to a German magazine, the GCHQ, which is the security services of the UK, had broken into Belgacom for obvious reasons of tapping on telephone conversations of several people, which it turned out later that also affected NATO and the European Commission simply because of their location in Belgium, but it also extended to other countries as well. So this was, let's say, a spook incident. And the British were kind enough to share this information with other intelligence services across the world. There was a name given to the operation. It was called Operation Socialist. I have no idea how secret services come up with names, and it doesn't really matter. And this is also, everything comes from the Spiegel, but it has not been either confirmed or denied, of course. This started in 2011. It came after the Snowden revelations, actually. Now, attack highlights again. Well, first step, in-depth reconnaissance. So if you want to attack an organization, the first thing you do is you try to map how they are organized, right? Then there was another purpose here, to identify key employees related to maintenance security. Actually, they targeted communications engineers that were involved with configuring systems and with maintaining systems. So they did that. They monitored the browsing habits of the engineers, and then they launched what is known as a quantum insert attack. What is this? This is a special case of attack where you actually fish someone into visiting a specific page, which then redirects to another page, and then from that one you can insert a keylogger. Actually, that was the technique used there on your machine, and from then on, of course, you can get access to anything that that guy types, which means you get passwords, you get credentials. Okay. We know what the platform was. It was Regin. You can Google it. There is much information about it. It's not actually malware. It's a platform, because it's much more than a virus or a Trojan. It allows you to do many more things as well. Okay. Third example. This is of national interest. This is 2 years ago. There hasn't been too much information about it. I mean, in detail, because most of it, I think, didn't turn out to be an incident at all in many cases. But the extent of the potential interest was high because nearly 300 Norwegian companies in the oil and gas energy industry, they have been warned by NSM that something is going on. And this is why this didn't necessarily turn into an incident for all of them. Okay. But 50 of them had already reported that they had been hacked, including Statoil, of course. And you probably know that there has been a more recent incident with Statoil. It was in the news, with an Indian guy that did a mistake in operating something, and this resulted in a cyber incident. What was the method again? Well, phishing campaigns. Emails directed at certain employees with key privileges and functions. You know, usually these guys, they're managers, right? These are the most useless people if you want to keep them aware of security or of the need not to respond to emails or to click on something that they don't need to click and things like that. And this is why most of the campaigns target those people. Or they would either target managers or their secretaries. Because what it works there, it's again kind of a social engineering thing. Assume that you're the secretary to a top manager guy, and then an email comes saying, you know what? The company should have paid an invoice that was due yesterday, and you have not done this, and we will take you to the courts because of that. It's not about a few thousand kroner, of course. It's an invoice which is larger than that, and it comes, or apparently comes, of course, from a source that you know. So what is your expected reaction? You click to see what the invoice is about, right? That's all it takes. Good. So this is what happened there. Email attachments. And of course then, again, it was keyloggers and things like that. This is the final one. I selected this for two reasons. One is that I know that we are having some Erasmus students from Germany attending the course, so I wanted something, giving points to Germany. And this was not, this is a joke. The real reason was that after Stuxnet, I guess you know Stuxnet, right? Okay, good. After Stuxnet, this is the first documented case where we have physical damage connected to a cyber attack. So, still works, steel mill, actually German steel mill. What happened was this, December 2014, the BSI, Bundesamt für Sicherheit in der Informationstechnik, right? I have the translation there for those poor fellows that do not understand German. Okay. So it's the Federal Office for Information Security in Germany. It's not the Secret Service. They released their annual findings, and that's when the incident became known. So a malicious actor had infiltrated a steel facility. The adversary used again spear phishing email, gain access to the corporate network, and then move on to the plant network. And, they knew what they were doing. You can actually reconstitute their actions by looking at the logs, provided that the logs that you are keeping are those that you need to keep, no more and no less, and in a format such that you can use for tracing back what had happened. This assumption doesn't necessarily hold in industrial settings for a variety of reasons. the most prevalent of which, I would say, is that we're talking about devices that have not been designed with security in mind at all, right? A programmable logic controller, which is a device that is being used to control a process, an industrial process, has not been designed, the PLC, has not been designed with a view that it should log activity to be used for forensically analyzing, let's say, an incident, or even for intrusion detection. So the assumption doesn't necessarily hold that you can trace it back. But in any case, we can do things. They knew what they were doing, and they were able to impact critical process components. Practically, what happened is that they sabotaged the furnace. So we had physical damage out of this. And as I said in the beginning, the only other case we've known was Stuxnet. Case of the Iranian case. Okay, on-site personnel, industrial operators were the targeted group. As already said, spear phishing and so on, and the malware detected was Havix and Black Energy. Yes. Yes. Okay, the point raised by Patrick was that in the Stuxnet case, the malware was implanted using a USB stick. This is correct, absolutely. But I missed the question. Ah, yes, okay. Yeah, well, actually, yeah, thank you. The question was, in the Stuxnet case, then, the physical systems or the, let's say, industrial control systems, it was a SCADA system practically, right? It was disconnected from, physically, disconnected from the rest of the network, the operational network, right? Yeah. And this is why the only way to get the malware in was through a USB stick or any other means of physical access to the computing equipment there. But there is a difference here, because here all those infiltrations, they came through the network, right? And thanks for the question, because that allows me to highlight what we have been doing wrong and why these things will increase, they will not decrease. The problem is this. Consider the history of security, information security, starting, let's say, from the 60s, right? But I don't want to take you that far back. This is a certain way not to go through the 70 slides that I have, but the point is this. We are in a security mess today, right? Okay. Why was that? Very briefly. Because we are using an infrastructure that had not been designed with security in mind, and I'm speaking about the internet. You all know that the internet started in the 60s. It was meant to connect secure facilities, military facilities, okay? And it was meant to be a closed infrastructure. Now, question to you, as engineers. You're requested to connect facilities that are by themselves secure with something that no one else, except military personnel, of course, who are trusted, right, can have access to. Do you need to design security in it? Well, now you know that yes, because you've seen the results. But at that time, the goal was not to do it securely. The goal was do it, work, let's have it working, right? So internet didn't have any security in it from the beginning by design. What we have done is patching things to secure the internet. Now, so what's the end line? You have an inherently insecure communication medium, right? Okay, now let's go on the computing side. In the early days, security, information security, was equivalent to physical security. You weren't born then, okay? Maybe, well, I was, but I was in my pram, probably. But at that time, in order to operate a machine, you had to physically go into what was called the console room, right? So information security equals physical security. You lock the door of the console room, that's it, fine, nice and easy, correct? Okay. Then we started multitasking, and all these systems were batch systems at that time. Okay. So what was the first problem we had to solve? Security in the memory allocation. Different users and different tasks should not be able to go across areas of memory. That was the first problem that we had to face as security. And in fact, it is still a problem. Buffer overflow, you know that it is still one of the major problems we have. That's the origin. Anyway, we came up with the personal computer. But that was designed initially as a home computer for entertainment, single user. Again, same question to you. Would you put security functionality into a machine that is only going to be used by one person? It's going to be used for entertainment, and you want it to be cheap so that people buy it. So yeah, what's the answer? The camera doesn't show you, but yes, you're smiling. The answer is no security there at all. And then these things evolved into what? Into something. Today's desktops, laptops, and things like that, which we have decided to run critical applications on. Now, put one and one together. You have inherently insecure computing environments connected through an inherently insecure communications media. What would you expect? Of course we are in a mess, and that's good for you, because you will have jobs to do. Now, what's the next mistake? We took all that, because up till now, what we have are the operational networks in industry. What you would say, ERPs, for example, the business information systems. And we connected them to the industrial control systems, which of course have not been built with security in mind because of the same reasons, because physical security was all that we were concerned with. So what do you have? What's the end result? You have an industrial control system, no security at all, connected to the internet, for God's sake. That's how it all comes about. And that's why we need to look into the security of the infrastructure. And this brings me to the point that I want to make, why the name of the group is Critical Infrastructure Security and Resilience. The reason being that in the past, we could assume that we would be able to come up with security solutions that would keep the bad guys out, right? So keep our system reasonably secure. Nowadays, we have to change the assumption. And the assumption is that we will not be able to keep the bad guys out. So we will be attacked, and we will be successfully attacked. So the question then becomes what? Can we design systems that will still be able to operate under attack, of course at a reduced operational level, but still functioning? The reason being, of course, again, because we're speaking about functions that are critical to the society. So we can't simply say, okay, we shut it down, we clean it up, and then we start it up again. Doesn't work. Okay? Good. Are we supposed, Patrick, are we supposed to have a break? Okay, good. Fine. So, trying to terrify you again, this is a report by the National Cybersecurity and Communications Integration Center. This is American, of course, and this is the Industrial Control Systems, CERT. And it gives you an idea of what kind of incidents we had in 2015. That's only for the United States. And you can see the sectors affected here. Critical manufacturing is one thing, the biggest. Energy, transportation, only a tiny 6% on information technology. Okay, and so on and so forth. So where would you concentrate your resources if you were to think strategically? Not to IT. Okay. Second point. Again from the same report. Infection vector. All of this happened because somehow, some malware was inserted into a system, more or less. Okay. What were the methods used? Well, it turns out that in 110, which is approximately, what, 40%? Something like that. Of the total, we don't know. Because we were not able to ascertain the means of infection. But another almost 40% is spear phishing. Okay? And all the rest, well, there is some brute force. Okay. There is insider. This is abuse of authorized access is actually an insider attack. So someone from the inside did it. Weak authentication is only 18 incidents in 300, and network scanning and probing is 26. So up till now, and before I take you to the next slide, which I need to remind myself of what it is. Yeah, okay. I'm seeing the same thing that you're seeing. Otherwise, I would have to sit behind that, and I don't like that, really. So if I take a sneak from time to time, please excuse me. Any conclusions up till now? I'm not asking. Just try your own thinking, and we'll come to that. We will discuss those conclusions. But let me give you another piece of information. These are the top six weaknesses discovered again by the same center in 2015. So the area, they are not in any hierarchical ranking. Okay. So boundary protection protection was one. And then list functionality, authenticator management, identification and authentication, list privilege, and allocation of resources. I don't want to go in detail through that. You will be able to look at it at your leisure when you take hold of the slides, which will be uploaded, of course. But the common denominator is that these are not very sophisticated technical vulnerabilities, right? Most of them. Okay, so that's a good time to break. Who is the weakest link in security? You know that security is a chain, okay? Who is the weakest link? That's one answer, the user. Any other offerings? Does that mean that you agree? Okay. Well, if this is the case, then after the break, we should discuss a little bit what we do, and maybe we change our mindsets about how to secure critical systems. How about that? Okay? Good. Thank you. No. Now everyone is here, yes. Okay, so starting from this, the view that we usually take when it comes to the security and resilience of critical infrastructures is what is called the holistic approach. Have you come across this term before? Does the word holistic mean something to you? Is it well understood? It's a Greek word, unfortunately. I'm not using it because of that, and this is not my approach. Okay, it's a more general, I would say, way of thinking. But it means looking at it as a whole rather than looking at pieces of something. Okay, so that's the holistic approach. And what it boils down to when we take it to security, well, one thing is that we look at people, processes, and technology, because these are the three constituents of what makes up a critical infrastructure. It's not only technology, it's not only people, it's all three of them together. So the idea goes that if you want to secure the whole infrastructure, then you have to look at all three elements, not separately, but as a unified whole, hence the term holistic. And you need to do that through the life of the cybersecurity risk management. So how do we approach it? Well, we start from secure concepts. What does security mean in our setting, in our particular setting? We define our security requirements for the critical infrastructure that we're trying to protect. We design securely. We build and test securely whatever security solutions we propose or we come up with. Then we need to make sure that we have secure operation and maintenance. And when the time comes, secure disposal. Okay? The same approach can be used in any information system as well. It doesn't necessarily have to be critical infrastructure. But when it comes to critical infrastructures, this is even more so a necessity to look at it like this. By the way, if you do that, you know that one of the barriers for technology adoption when it comes to IT, technology adoption and communications, is the level of trust that users will put into the technology. Once this barrier has been overcome, then things become easier. But it's not easy to do that in the first place. And in fact, one of the reasons why the dot-com story in the beginning of 2000 did blow up, right? It was a bubble actually. One of the reasons, I'm not saying that it was the main reason, was the lack of trust of the consumers to the online marketing concept. Now the same holds true for things that are coming. Consider, for example, the Internet of Things, right? Which is more or less, it has already arrived, but it will be more prevalent in the future. If we have incidents with the Internet of Things, which we will undoubtedly have, I have some slides on the Internet of Things. I'm not sure whether we will get that far, but anyway, again, a preview of the preview. When we do, it's very easy to lose trust of the user when a security breach happens. The trust, if you could, let's say, put it on a graph, it would go down like this. And then if you want to reinstate it, it takes time, it's gradual, and it takes effort as well. So whatever increases trust and assurance to our security solutions is to the benefit of the overall situation. Now, oh, sorry. This one I didn't comment on. I will come back to that later on. Do you know this guy? Have you heard about him? Well, one of the very good cryptographers we have. There are, of course, dissected opinions about him, diverging, I would say. But still, I mean, he's pretty well known. I think you're right. I can't say I love him or I hate him, but he has some quotes that I like. They support my arguments. That's one of them. Okay. So right now you might think, am I not supposed to try also to get as many more students into the technology track as possible? Yeah, but you see, that's what I'm doing. But still, I think that all us technology, I'm an engineer, right? All my studies have been in engineering, electrical engineering, computer engineering, and communication engineering. But I think that it's absolutely necessary for security engineers to keep in mind that technology is not the only thing they should be caring about. And that's why I talk to you about the holistic approach and things like that. Okay? But, of course, the best place to learn about security isn't the technology track. That said, I'm going on. Okay? Now, where are we? Oh, a few words about critical information infrastructures, which is a little bit different than critical infrastructures. Actually, it's a subset, but not only a subset, as you will see. Again, starting from the formal definition of at the European level, but I would go directly to the Norwegian one. It's simpler, straightforward. Is defined as critical infrastructure for electronic communications. So that's what Norway believes it's the critical information infrastructure, and this is wrong. And it is wrong because of this. Critical information infrastructure is anything that either by itself is an information infrastructure, like the communications infrastructure, okay? But it is also that part of information infrastructure that supports the operation of other critical infrastructures, right? So, of course, the underlying communications infrastructure is a critical information infrastructure because upon communications, everything else resides. But in the case of Norway, particular example, isn't also the satellite infrastructure, which is partly critical information infrastructure, again, something that you depend on, that we depend on. All the other infrastructures, don't they have components that are actually information infrastructures without which they wouldn't be able to operate? That's the argument. Okay. So this is actually the intersection between critical infrastructures, critical information infrastructures, and another concept that we will come to in a minute. By the way, are you aware of ENISA? What ENISA is? Well, you should be. Okay. ENISA is the European Network and Information Security Agency. This is the agency, the one agency of the European Union that has been mandated with the task of increasing the level of cybersecurity in Europe, network and information security. Okay, so it does several things. I invite you to look at their website. You will find not only very useful resources for your work, but you will also see what they are doing, which is actually helping the member states in improving the security of their infrastructures, critical infrastructures, IT, whatever, you name it. Okay, so keep in mind that we will briefly come back to these national information infrastructures. And just as, again, an indication of how important critical information infrastructures may be, these are a few facts coming from the ENISA report. One of the most interesting things, at least to those of you interested in telecommunications, is that ENISA gathers all the information security incidents that affect the telecommunications sector across Europe, and they produce one single report every year. So every telecom operator in the European Union is obliged by law to report security incidents not only to the national regulator, so ENCOM in the case of Norway, but also through ENCOM to ENISA. And they compile a comprehensive report of what has happened with regards to security incidents in the telecom sector every year. This is now let's open a parenthesis. What would you expect? Because in this report and in this incident, of course, one of the key aspects is what was the root cause of the incidents. What would you think in the telecom sector be the primary root cause of security incidents? Malware? What? Insider attacks? You name it. I don't want to classify threat agents for you. Not now. We'll do that later. But what would come to mind as the most important root cause of cases in the telecom sector? Any offerings? Come on. Just guess. Is it malware? Is it attacks through the net by hackers? Well, it's bad, wrong system configurations. That's the primary root cause of security incidents in the telecom sector, by far. More than 60%. So, as security engineers, you know what your targets should be. Okay. Now, this is again from the same report, and it identifies key areas for action if we want to secure our critical infrastructures in a national setting. And these are policies: the threat intelligence, emergency preparedness, risk management, legislation, and governance structure. These are recommendations to the member states, so this is what should be done to create a framework that would be sufficient for protecting critical information infrastructures. And if you take all these together, these would constitute the national security strategy, cybersecurity strategy, which we will come to after a couple of slides. But for now, This was the European way of looking at things. If you look at the American way of looking at things, which is a slightly different perspective, the National Institute of Standards and Technology, NIST, that's the standardization organization in America, again, a very good resource for security resources. I don't know how many of you are familiar with the SP series of publications of NIST. Familiar? Okay. So you know what it's about. So they have come up with a framework for improving critical infrastructure security that actually identifies what they call four core functions. So according to NIST, the view is that you should be looking at the identification of what you need to do, protecting, detecting, and then responding. And graphically, I think this is here. So identification includes this. Practically is understanding where you are, understanding the organization, understanding what your goals are, understanding what your assets are. Then moving on to protecting, and this is where technology comes mostly into the picture, but not only technology. Detecting, that's what you will be doing with Slobodan Petrovic in the next semester in intrusion detection, right, mostly, and of course other things. Respond, again, I remind you of the resilience aspect, right? In the past, we would go up till here. But now we have to assume that we will be attacked, and therefore we need to respond. So how do we respond? That's how we respond. And we further assume that we will need to recover. So we will sustain damage, and therefore we should have there the tools that will allow us to recover efficiently and in both terms of effort and time. Now, in here, you would also recognize it's not listed explicitly, but forensic technologies are there. I mean, part of the response to an incident is also the forensic investigation of what had happened, because that will be needed if you wish to take the case judicially to the courts of law or whatever else. And in any case, just to be able to analyze the incident after it has happened so that you can learn
lessons of how not to do things and how to do things again. Okay, so now, a few words about national cybersecurity strategies, as I promised to you. I think we have already covered the first bullet. It is also there just to serve as an introduction to the second bullet. And this is because the second bullet, actually what it says, is that the nation's security and economic well-being is a shared responsibility. And it is a shared responsibility to the state, to the citizens, to the private sector, to the public sector, to everyone. Okay? So no one can say cybersecurity is not my business. I have nothing to do about that. Okay? And if you start from this idea, that means that whatever strategy needs to be devised has to be a national strategy, otherwise it wouldn't work. So this is what lies behind the national cybersecurity strategy concept. ITU, familiar with ITU? International Telecommunications Union. This is the branch of the United Nations that looks into telecommunication issues. Everything related to telecom standards, you name it, comes from ITU. And also, in terms of standardization, it comes from ISO as well. But ITU is a major resource for international regulation regarding telecommunications. And they have been running exercises to assess the capability of nations regarding cybersecurity. The good news, Norway, up top, number one in the region, in Europe. I think it's number two in the world. Number one, I think, is Singapore, which is nice. Okay, it's nice to know. But it is also useful to know that Norway is the most digitalized country in the world. And that means that it is also the most vulnerable country in the world. So it needs to be up top in the capacity for cybersecurity. Okay? That's why you're here. That's why we are here. Okay? Good. I will not go into the details of the strategy model, but again, at your leisure, you can look at it. This is not a very long report. You can find it if you Google it. So it's a few pages long, so you can go into the details. This is the map of Europe showing the nations that have developed a national cybersecurity strategy. Norway is not there because it's not a member state. Okay, but of course, it does have a cybersecurity strategy, which is a quite comprehensive one. The yellow ones is Sweden and Greece, I'm afraid. This is an interactive map, by the way. If you go there, you will see also, if you click on countries, you will see the most salient characteristics of the strategies. Officially, these are under development. Unofficially, I can tell you this is not under development. But I don't know what happens in Sweden. Or at least it is in a very slow process of being developed. Now, coming to threat actors and agents, and as I said in the beginning, we would mainly focus on these ones, and we have. So I have about half an hour to go quickly through the rest items, because these are the other subjects that those of you that will select to take the course next year will be exposed to. So threat actors and agents. This is just to remind you what a threat is, what a vulnerability is, what an asset is, what a countermeasure is, and so on and so forth. Okay? I'm sure that you must have this picture visualized in your mind, because this is what drives security practically. Okay? Well, I'm not saying this one in particular. It could be anything like that. But the whole story starts from assets, right? Owners have assets. Assets are exposed to threats because there exist threat agents who exploit attack vectors to launch the threats. against the asset. So these, together with vulnerabilities, constitute risks. And what are we as security experts supposed to do? Come up with countermeasures that will manage the risk. That's what we're actually doing. And the whole problem of security is to come up with efficient, in many ways, countermeasures for managing the risk. A usual misconception is that if we can put the best solutions that we have in place, this is the best way to manage risk. It's not. Because when you try to manage risk, you shouldn't be using a machine gun to shoot at a mosquito, and you should not be using an air pistol to shoot at an elephant. Both of them are of equal importance. And this is why the whole, in the holistic approach, the whole process of securing something, whatever that is, particularly critical infrastructure, needs to be risk management oriented. That's where we start from. You know this guy? Sun Tzu. I recommend the book. Even though it is, a few centuries, millennia actually old, it is still really very valid. You will see some quotes there. So who are the enemies? It's what we call today the threat agents. Right? So threats have threat agents. Well, this is a classification of cybersecurity threat agents, according to ANISA again. The classification includes not only threat agents, which are the hostile part of it, so it's this part of the picture, but also friendly, right? So hopefully you are on the friendly side, and you are, and us. You are researchers, ethical hackers, security agents, law enforcement agents, and cyber whatever? Soldier. Yeah, okay, yes. Forsvarets. Anyone from Forsvarets? Yeah, okay. Cyber soldiers there. So these are the friendly forces. And these, of course, are the hostile forces. And this is what is most interesting here, because if we're looking at threat agents, we should be able to analyze their capabilities with regard to this classification. Capability is one item. So are we speaking of those that have resources available? They are capable or not, and things like that. So we will be looking into this in the course and analyzing threat agents. And also, this is a taxonomy, which I'm sure you can't see. And this is why I have you given you the source. So if you can look into it. I did experiment with all sizes possible, but still it wasn't possible to visualize that. But as you can see, it is again a taxonomy and a classification of threats, which is quite useful. And we will be going into more detail in the course next year. So this is what we will be looking at when we look at threat actors and agents. These are the more, let's say, detailed subjects under that subject. Okay, next subject in the course of next year, modeling of infrastructures. This is the nightmare of a security engineer working for critical infrastructures, because it shows you, this is only a very partial view of the interdependencies that exist between critical infrastructures, right? Well, it's not accidental that electric power is in the center. Without power, you can't do much. Right? Well, you can't do much over a prolonged period of time, of course. We do have solutions if we have to manage for a few hours, perhaps, but not more than that. So this is why this is in the center. But unfortunately, telecom is also in the center. You know why? One more reason is because nowadays, this infrastructure relies upon the telecom infrastructure, because many things are being done remotely. So the network, the energy network, is being controlled remotely using, of course, telecom infrastructure. So if the telecom infrastructure is not enough, then the energy network may go down simply because the communication is not there, and vice versa. And of course, you can extend all these arguments to all the other critical infrastructures. So all of them are like this, interwoven. There are several ways of analyzing these interdependencies, and the titles are there, again, for more details, next fall semester. And again, these are the detailed subjects within the subject. Okay, cyber-physical systems and their security, that's my pet. So more, a little bit more detail on this. As not all of you are familiar with cyber-physical systems, let me give you motivation. This is what Google believes that the world will look like in the near future. It has already started to look like that, more or less. And those of you that are interested in the economic aspects of information technology as well, you might be aware of the fact that Google has started for a long time now acquiring very diverse companies like, I don't know, refrigerator manufacturers or automobile manufacturers or satellites or whatever. The reason, of course, being what? That because they have that kind of vision, what their company strategy is that they would like to be part of all these independent markets so that they can provide the medium that will connect them. Okay? So everything connected in the future, through networking, of course. And this is actually what we call the Internet of Things. But this is not the latest. Have you come across the term the Internet of Everything? Yeah, we are quite good at inventing terms. The Internet of Everything is the Cisco's way of looking at the future. And, well, I don't have a slide here for this, but what it is, the Internet of Things is just one building block of the Internet of Everything. So according to Cisco, the Internet of Everything contains the Internet of Things, so all that. It contains the cloud, because all the computing will be done in the cloud. So the vision of the 60s that led to the development of the Multics system, which is, of course, the predecessor of Unix, was what? The vision was this. How do we use electric power today? Well, you only have to find the plug, right? And you plug in and you get it, correct? None of us would dream of carrying about his own power generator to fulfill their power needs, right? Why can't we do that with computing? So the vision was there in the 60s. Can we provide computing power as a utility? So can we have, at that time, that's what they were thinking, you know? Can we have plugs everywhere so that we can plug in and have all the computing power that we need, just like the electric energy or the water? Right? Okay. And the answer came about 40-something years later. The answer is yes. Well, yeah. Cloud computing is almost there already. So Cisco includes cloud, Internet of Things, and of course it includes people as well in the Internet of Everything because we are all connected. I do hope that they don't mean that we will all be transformed into cyber organisms with chips everywhere, you know, and things like that. That I wouldn't like very much, but I do hope that they don't mean that. Now, let me also try to resolve another misconception. People think that everything is going to be IP. This is not the case. If you go to industry, IP is a very small minority. Industry uses other protocols. And this is where additional problems come into the picture. That's why one of the subjects later will be the protocols, IEC something and all that that they gave you as titles that Stephen will be teaching about. They don't have the characteristics of the IP stack. Of course, they're much more limited in capability to support any security solutions, and this is where the difficulties come in from. Okay? So don't think that everything will be IP. It will not for a long time to come. Now, what is a cyber-physical system? Well, It's a buzzword again. The Americans came up with it. Okay. But what it is, roughly, you don't have to read through that. The main idea is this. Imagine a system where it has a cyber part and it has a physical part. For the time being, I know that you might be thinking of very different sizes of such things. But I can give you one example. The energy infrastructure is a cyber-physical system or a collection of cyber-physical systems, right? Why? Because there is a cyber element which controls a physical element. And it's not always possible. They interact very closely, these two, let's say, layers. And it's not always possible to attribute a certain event to a cyber action or to a physical action. These are a bit combined. Now, this is a good example of a very large size of cyber-physical system. But actually, we have cyber-physical systems that are tiny, like those used in your automobiles, embedded things, right? These are cyber-physical systems. So your braking system in your car does have some cyber capability. And in fact, it has been shown, was it the Jeep that was hacked? I think so, right? So the braking system of the Jeep was hacked because, of course, it relies upon an embedded system that has a cyber component, which is connected through the entertainment system, the entertainment network in the Jeep, which is connected to the internet, and therefore it has been shown that you can attack and you can hack the braking system of the Jeep and you have you killed. Okay. So they come from minuscule to large scale. Okay, and I already gave you the example of the grid and the example of a car. In fact, I can't remember the number of embedded systems that we have in today's automobiles, but it's a huge number of embedded systems. I mean, it's a terrifying number. Okay, this is graphically depicting the structure of a cyber-physical system, and we will be using that kind of abstraction to go into the problem of how do we secure such systems. And this is just another example of a cyber-physical system. Now, these systems, and why do we look at them separately? Because they have some characteristics that make our lives as security engineers much more difficult than any traditional IT system. And if you look at them through the well-known PDCA cycle, have you heard the term? Obviously, any process-oriented thing follows, well, or should follow a PDCA cycle if you want to optimize it, to improve it or to optimize it. The problem is this, or one of the problems that we will be discussing in some detail. When you have a cyber-physical system, this is, as I already said, is a composition of a cyber element and the physical element. Now, these things are usually being designed on the physical side with requirements like reliability, availability, safety, things like that in mind. Okay. And this is what we used to call in the past the reliability engineering world. We then moved into the so-called dependability engineering world. And then we, the security guys, came in and said, hey, it's not only dependability and reliability. We are here as well because you now have the cyber elements. But these, unfortunately, are two different worlds because this is what our characteristics are. Whoops. So we primarily look at the CIA triad. Well, you know this is a little bit outdated now, but anyway, this is a good paradigm. We still use it, confidentiality, integrity, availability. More or less, we are empirically oriented. Imagine a civil engineer, when they design a building, they know exactly, they have very good mathematical models that allow them to predict how the building will function in any situation, structural situation, right? Do we have any kind of tool like that? I mean, this is not only true for security, it's also true for the whole IT or maybe the software, let's say, industry, but at the system level as well. We have no formal models capable of allowing us to see what will happen if we put this and this together. No way, even though we may be aware of the characteristics of both. So that's why we are empirically oriented. It is subjective when you are called in to identify risks. Do you know of any risk analysis or risk assessment methodology that is not subjective? I don't. If you do, please let me know afterwards. Qualitative, well, this is one of the reasons actually for being subjective. I mean, if something is quantitative, then you subtract subjectivity out of it. And the lack of mathematical models. Now these guys, resilience is what interests them. Availability, they are objective, they are quantitative, and they use extensively mathematical models and tools. Question, can we bring those two worlds together? Answer, we've been trying to for the past 30 years, still unsuccessfully. The reason being that even though we do have techniques and proposals that can do that in theory, the practical, the real world is a bit different. And I can give you just a very small example. You can imagine what kind of effort and money goes into the design of a chip that goes into your automobile, right? I mean, I don't need to give you figures, but you can see that this is quite extensive. Now, this has not been designed with security in mind, of course. And then you come and you say to the safety engineer or the reliability engineer, well, you know, you need to modify the design because I'm not happy with it from a security viewpoint. What do you think will happen? I can tell you that you will be kicked. I don't need to tell you where you will be kicked, but you will be kicked. Okay. One of the problems, cost efficiency, is actually our biggest problem in getting security across in a world which has embedded system, cyber-physical systems, and things like that. Okay, so we'll be looking into those as well. Where am I? Ah, okay, control system security. That's Stephen's stuff, but I will give you a preview. Okay, this is what an industrial control system from a security perspective looks like. And this is where you should go if you want more information about it. It's a NIST SP publication on industrial control system security. So actually what you have is you have a process which is controlled. That's what industrial control systems do. Okay, at the abstract level, that's what they all do. It has sensors because you need to measure things. It has actuators because what you do is what? You try to control the whole process by measuring through your sensors and by changing parameters of the process through your actuators. So this is the central idea there. Well, nowadays, of course, you have remote diagnostics and maintenance, and you have, invariably, the human element is there, so human-machine interface. Homework for you. Identify possible vulnerabilities at this abstract level, possible threat agents, possible threats here. If you were to depict them using red arrows, I guess the picture would be filled with red arrows. So you'll go through that in the course next year. And this is another way of looking at it. Well, actually, it's a complementary way because this doesn't give you the communication perspective. But unfortunately, there is also that nice communication perspective there, so more red arrows pointing into this. Lots of work to do. So this is what we will be looking into with regards to control systems security. By the way, I've been using this term and I haven't asked you whether you're familiar with it. Do you know what a SCADA system is? Okay, good. And this is the final subject, excluding the application areas that I already mentioned to you, the case studies, under which You will just look into, well, just, that's a lot of work. You will be looking into two specific protocols that are industrial communication protocols, and you will be discussing and analyzing security properties and ways to improve the security of these protocols. And after that, we will have case studies in these, at least this is the plan now, to use these critical infrastructures. And again, the plan is to use real cases so that we can actually have a real-world view of what's happening and not imaginary kind of things. Okay. Before closing for today, one thing that I didn't mention, but I would like to for you to keep in mind, I have very lightly used the word privacy in the presentation. Okay? But I do consider it very important in the world of the future, which is going to be your world, it's not going to be my world, but you will be the ones that will be living in that, and therefore you bear more responsibility for that. You should be able to make your own decisions about the right balance between security and privacy. And this will have to be done at both a society level, but at the personal level as well, because obviously individuals are those that form the what is called the societal view. Okay, so this is Benjamin Franklin, President of the United States, 1706 to 1790. And I like this quote because it can actually be interpreted in today's terms. If you change freedom to privacy and you keep the word security, then this is exactly one of the dilemmas that we have to face in the brave new world. So please be aware, whatever you do as security engineers, keep that in mind. Okay, thank you very much. Any questions? I guess we finished in time for questions as well. What? Ah! I don't use it, I don't do it very often.
No questions?
No questions? Sometimes yes, sometimes no. Let me repeat the question. SCADA systems, I would generalize it. In an industrial control setting system, including the IoT by example, the question was, are these data being trafficked in a setting like that, encrypted or non-encrypted? The answer is sometimes yes, sometimes no. The problem is when it is encrypted, techniques like deep packet inspection would not be applicable without using very special techniques. We do have ways of dealing with problems like that, because obviously for intrusion detection or even for monitoring, you do need to go into packet inspection. And if this is proprietary encryption, of course the manufacturer will not give you the keys, not necessarily. So you would have to look into encrypted traffic. We can do, I'm sure you know that we can do some information mining even within encrypted data, but not as much as we would like to. There are other techniques that one can use, but unfortunately in many cases you just have to accept the fact that you're dealing with black boxes in terms of equipment that do not provide you the information that you as a security engineer would like to have, and therefore you have to interoperate with the vendors and find innovative solutions for doing that. Not always. Okay. Anything else?
More questions? Okay, if not.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Very interesting presentation.
To do my marketing.
Yeah. Okay. For this course, I I guess you already announced that next week there will be a trial exam. Will be in K105 actually. That will not be broadcasted online. That will be quite dull looking at number of people making an exam. I will upload the exam anyway afterwards. The idea is be there in time. I will give some explanation before the exam starts, and then you'll get a approximately 90 minutes exam, which is half of what it would be in the real exam. The session afterwards, the exercise session, you can ask questions about the exam, about anything in principle on the on this course. Yeah, clear. One other thing that could be interesting. Now we're reaching the end of the first semester. Most of you soon have to make a decision on what track to choose. I guess most of you will already have a good idea. For those that don't have the exact idea yet, use the opportunity in the last couple of weeks to visit the staff at NISLAB. Go ask people. If you're interested in technology, you can come and visit me. If you're interested in digital forensics, go and talk to who was the track champion? Is that? No, I think it's Stefan. Go talk to Stefan Axelsson. Yeah, be a bit active so that you made the best choice. Yeah? Okay, thanks a lot.